All right, everybody, welcome to a very special edition of the Midnight Ride Podcast. I feel like I've already jumped the shark by saying it's a very special edition. But to me it is, because I'm talking to one of my all-time favorite players tonight, Mr. Taylor Twellman, Revs legend. What else can you say? Thanks so much for coming on the Midnight Ride.
No problem. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's great. And obviously, I mean, there's a lot of the big news in Revolution Nation is about Steve Nichol, but, you know, I wanted to just quickly, you know, you lost a former teammate, right, with Mr. Griffiths, I believe. Did you hear about that? That's very sad news.
Yeah, it's, you know, I just got wind of it about early this morning. I've been flying around for the last 10, 11 days, and I mean, it just kind of leaves you, one, speechless, and two, just your heart goes out to his family and loved ones, because just reading the article and what happened to him, it's scary. And, you know, obviously my thoughts and prayers, as all of ours that played with Winston Griffiths, are with his family right now.
Yeah, that's obviously a always crushing blow, especially when somebody is so young. You really, it's kind of heart wrenching, and all.
Well, it puts this podcast in perspective. You know, we're going to talk about Steve Nichol and what a great run he had, but it just goes to show you life is way too short, and you live each day to the fullest because you never know when your time's up.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's, and you know, definitely words to live by in my lifetime anyway. And but let's, you know, this isn't about me. It's about the Revolution, and you know, obviously, as I said, big news, Steve Nichol. You know, why don't you start us off talking about a little bit about Stevie, what kind of guy he was, what it was like to work with, and your relationship with him?
Well, it's funny because, you know, when you look, you know, my quote on ESPN.com today was real simple. It was a hell of a run. When you just look at the sheer numbers, I mean, 10 years of the same organization, that means he was doing something right, because for a coach to be in the same organization at a professional level for 10 years, that means people had to be, you know, quite pleased with what you were doing. When I first met Stevie, it was, I just got found out I was going to New England, so I flew down to Brazil. And Fernando Clavijo and John Murphy, you know, introduced me at the draft. And I went home, grabbed a couple of things, and then flew down 2 days later. And Steve Nichol was there. And needless to say, it took me a solid 8 months, so all of 2002, to understand what he was saying and get through the accent.
That's great.
But there was a common theme that I had with Steve Nichol. And one was, off the field, he allowed myself to be who I was. He just allowed me to have fun, enjoy what I loved doing. We had that common thread because he did the same. You know, when the ball was away, he enjoyed life. He enjoyed, you know, just being around the guys. But the one thing was, he hated to lose. And he drafted guys and brought in guys starting in 2003 and 2004. He started bringing in guys that, to his credit, along with his staff, and that was, you know, John Murphy, and that was Paul Mariner, those guys, they brought in guys that wanted to win. And that was the common theme that Steve Nichol had from 2002 to 2008. And that group of guys will go down, you know, until the Revs won MLS Cup. That was the greatest stretch in their short time frame in the Revs and what we did there, and Steve Nichol's a huge part of that because he had to pull the strings and he had to manage the guys. But if anyone had the opportunity to be in a locker room, you would have never known we were pro athletes. We were just a bunch of guys that loved doing what we were doing, and we had a lot of fun doing it.
Right, and you mentioned some key names there. We'll talk about Murphy and He's always been a favorite of mine. I think he's definitely one of the unsung heroes of that era, so to speak. A lot of people remember Paul Mariner, obviously. His coach, his professional career preceded him. But a lot of guys tend to forget about John Murphy, and he's a guy that I've kind of tapped as a potential MLS coach, and maybe with a Revolution, given his past history. But we'll talk a little bit about that later. But you know, I wanted to you talk about the winning and that these guys wanted to win. I remember at one point I think it was just a couple of years ago, right around the time when you were forced to step away from the game, and I think I was on Comcast Sportsnet. I was watching you. You said something along the lines of, you can't win without scoring goals, and you kind of took that onus upon yourself, and despite the fact that you were injured and you know couldn't perform, you really kind of took that blame on yourselves. But now, after a couple of losing seasons in a row, how much blame should the fans lay at the feet of Steve Nichol? And you know, how much should we put on the players, and how much should we put on the front office?
Yeah, I mean, we'll go one step at a time. So we'll answer these so I can give you my opinion on it all. And if I forget, to go back to what you said, I took a lot of blame. And I'm not going to lie here and tell you, I'm not going to lie here and say to you that I do not see Steve Nichol being fired. And there's not part of me that thinks if only I was healthy playing, I don't know if this would be the situation. And that will always resonate with me. As Steve Nichol and I had a bond as our first years at the Revs were the same year. So there's always part of me that thinks, gosh darn it, if I was only healthy, if I only wasn't hurt dealing with post-concussion, I would have helped this team out tremendously. In saying that, if I was playing and this is what happened and the team finished last in the league, then if you want to put all the blame on the coach, then you're mistaken, because at the end of the day, your number is called by a guy.
Right.
And that's the head coach. But as a player, there's 11 guys on the field. Your job's to win the game. I don't care. The coach isn't playing the game. And as much as if Steve Nichol's going to take blame, as much when he took credit, it still was the 11 guys on the field playing, winning the game. Yes, he's got to pull the right strings. Yes, he's got to put the names together. But in reality, there's a gut check for every single player that's on that Revolution team today, because Steve Nichol just lost his job based on the on-the-field results.
Right.
And that's wins and losses. And so, as Steve Nichol is going to get the blame and he's dismissed and he's going to move on, that's not necessarily fair. It's got to be equally distributed, because the organization, the administration, the players, and the coaches all have to feel the blame. It's the way sports is. The head coach takes its fault, and sometimes the administrators take the fault, but as fans, you just can't. You just can't put all the blame, as in the Red Sox right now. If you're a fan of the Red Sox, if you're putting all the blame on Terry Francona, then it's not really an educated blame. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you have to – you'd think that it is kind of distributed, and you know, but you also have to look at a lot of fans out there, I think. You know, the team obviously lives in the shadow of the great Patriot organization. Lots of people have been questioning the ownership and the effectiveness of the front office, and you know, who's ultimately responsible here for assembling the team that's on the field, and has the league kind of surpassed?
Let me ask you then.
Go ahead.
Were those questions asked in 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007? The answer was no.
No, definitely not.
I was playing. I thought we were winning.
That's right.
You know, so I don't necessarily know that it's an ownership type of deal. I understand, as I've now stepped away and I work for ESPN and I did the Philly games, I understand the pain and the disappointment as fans to understand that you're not going to a soccer-specific stadium. There's nothing exciting. I understand that. But the fact is if you were going to Gillette Stadium and the team was still winning – sorry, the soccer-specific stadium is on the back burner.
Right.
The hardest thing as a fan, and this is where the questions lie, is why is Jeff Lorenowitz, Andy Dorman, Michael Parkhurst, James Riley, why are these guys, the young guys that did well early on in their career, why are they not on that team right now?
That's the question.
And those are the questions. And that's where, as fans, listen, I know you guys. You guys are very, fans are educated. I'm a fan myself. Sooner or later, fans are going to start asking the right questions. And they're going to demand answers. And I think that's what, as a Revolution family, that's what people want. People want answers now. And I don't know if the firing of Steve Nichol, is that going to give everyone the answer? I'm not too sure that is. Because the fact is, the players still are there. You know, so there's a lot of questions there. But you're not going to get me on the bandwagon of the owners. And I'll tell you why. Because I played for those owners, and we were very successful with the exact same thing they're doing right now.
So in your opinion, I've been on record as saying that the league has grown up around this team, and that the Revolution organization is kind of left behind, playing with a mentality that it's still 2002, 2003. When you guys were out building that core group of guys that you were able to take and have that great 4 or 5 year run, and you know, in 2008, 2009, you know, started to trickle off a little bit. I mean, you guys were doing great in 2008, won Superliga, all that stuff, and then towards the end of the season, just kind of tick,
injuries, yeah.
Everything caught up with you. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, that was a bad year for you, right?
Yep. No, 2008 was a tough year, but I'll tell you, losing the MLS Cup in 2007, that's when it started dissipating, and you could see it.
Yep. That's
when I started to know that this franchise, this organization needed to step up and make some moves. And that's the frustrating part. You know, go back to the 07 team. And I love those six. Don't get me wrong. That team was deadly with Clint Dempsey. But 07 was our year. 07 was easily the most complete team I had been on for the Revolution. Yet, you look at that, James Riley, Michael Parkhurst, Andy Dorman, Jeff Lorenowitz were all under the age of 25.
Right.
You know, and this is, and I'll give you inside the locker room, so many fans were upset with me wanting the opportunity to go to England and press the North End. You got to keep in mind, there was a decision there. I wasn't leaving on a free transfer, yet the four guys I even mentioned, Parkhurst, Dorman, Lorenzowicz, technically we traded for, but we didn't get anything for Corey Gibbs. So those are, you know, those guys could be on the team right now.
Right.
You know, and it's so easy. Don't get me wrong. This is obviously us talking, and it's easy to say what could have, should have, and all this. But those are three guys under the age of 25 that could have been, you know, imagine Lorenzowicz and Dorman on the team this year.
It would be a different team altogether.
Yeah, and we're not even talking the likes of, you know, yeah, of course you lose Rolf and Heaps and Swellman, but that always happens. It's a cycle. You're going to lose players, crazy injuries, whatever it is, but if your core group of guys, there was a foundation there, and I think that's when 2008 is when this started to fall apart.
Right. So, yeah, and given that happened, and now that, you know, the Revolution have made this massive, you know, organizational change by, you know, removing Steve Nichol.
Is it that massive, though?
Well, that's the question I'm asking you. Is it?
I don't know if it is. And I said this, too, and I'm sorry. I'm really good at interrupting you, so.
That's fine. I expected you to do most of the talking, so.
Yeah. I'm really good at interrupting people, so it's perfect. I'll just say what I'm good at. But, you know, I don't know if we know that answer yet, if it's massive or not. It's a huge blow because it's the psychological aspect of the Steve Nichol era is over.
Right.
But the question that all of us want to know, ex-players, current players, fans especially, is what's the pecking order? What are the questions? What are the management? Because now there's a new guy coming in, or new guys, we don't know assistant coaches, we don't know.
Right.
Who picks the players? Great question. Who negotiates the contract? Another great question. who makes decisions on preseason. These are all decisions that now people want to know, because forever when Steve Nichol was there, there was no pecking order. There was no treat. This guy does this, this guy does this, this guy does that. But now the question is, you say massive, we don't know that yet, because if you just insert a body in there,
it could be status quo.
Over, you know, Barbie?
I said it could be just, you know, continuing the status quo. If the rest of the organization is the same and you're just putting in a new coach there to be kind of a placeholder, so to speak. Is
exactly.
That, yeah.
That's ultimately the question that everyone wants to know as fans. And it's a great question. And by the way, and this is something that I've learned, and it's a sidetrack, but being done playing, and I've always understood it because I grew up in a sports family that played all sports. Whether it's good or bad news, people talking about it, it's great for the sport.
Yes, it
is. Awesome. And that's where our sport, my sport as well, they need to embrace this. This is awesome that people really want to know, fans are enthused about what is the pecking order? What's the answer to everything?
And
that's passion. That's what real sports is all about.
Yeah, and you look at this kind of the question that in particular with this particular organization, that this, and I'm going to go on record saying this is something that I've always felt, and I know other people have felt this way too, is that this is kind of a this organization was initially kind of started off as a spinoff of the Patriots organization, as a kind of a mini Patriots organization, and a lot of the same principles and mindsets that went into that they used to run the Patriots so effectively they tried to use in this, you know, new market where there isn't as much exposure, and they're being very secretive and very, you know, withdrawn from the public about how the decisions are made. And, you know, there's rumors out there about, you know, soccer specific stadium that's, you know, maybe Jonathan Kraft last night said it's maybe 12 months away before they get started on the project. But, you know,
I think his answer was 12 months away from the answer.
12 months away from the answer. Well, that's even worse. But
it's so tough. Keep going, Hank.
But you know what I'm getting at here is that is this organization, you know, kind of lost its way? I mean, are there too many levels of management? Well, you've got Kraft, you've got Sunil Gulati, Brian Bilello, Mike Burns, and whoever the new coach is. Are there too many layers of management in this organization?
Well, you got to ask that to who's the new guy. Correct?
Well,
because
yeah.
Ultimately, the guy coming in is going to ask that exact same question. He's going to ask that exact what you said. What's the pecking order? Who do I answer to? Who's picking players? Who does the scheduling? Who does this?
That's always been the question.
Go ahead.
I mean, that's always been the question. Like, who's the guy ultimately in charge? I mean,
right, but when it's working, you don't have to ask the question.
That's right. That's right.
See, and that's where now it's good. Let's ask the question. Let's delegate. What is everyone's responsibility? You know, what is Sunil Gulati's role? What is that role? What is Mike Burns' role? What is Bilello's role? If the new guy comes in, what's his role? Does he hire, you know, you look at Peter Novak. Peter Novak in Philadelphia brings in his own guy.
That's right. You know, and out of all those guys, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. And that's where you look at the jobs around this country now. That's going to be interesting, right? So the new guy gets interviewed, okay, so is it Mike Burns and I? Is it Bilello, Burnsy and I? Is it Sunil? What are the roles here? Or am I just coming in, writing the starting lineup on the board, and then you guys take care of everything else? And this is why, listen, Steve Nichol has one of, if not the greatest runs, minus the MLS Cup, which I'll bang my head against the wall, no pun intended, after we get off the phone for this for him. But the fact is, for this organization to grow, I think this move had to happen because now there's more than just who's the head coach question.
Right.
Where is this organization going to go?
It definitely opens up a whole lot of questions here because, you know, people, when coaches fail or when teams don't succeed, everybody's always quick to point out to point their fingers at the coach because he's the one who's supposedly making the decisions. I have friends that live in England and overseas, and they've been wondering why Steve Nichol isn't bringing in new players and new this. And I try to explain to them, so this organization doesn't run like that. It's we don't really know how it's run like this, but. Yes, he's ultimately responsible for the performance on the pitch as much as he can be in terms of, putting the best 11 out on the field, which he said time and time again, our best players are out there. But in how handcuffed was he in picking those 11? I mean,
I don't know if he was, and people are shocked. They're going to hear me. I'm not so sure. Listen, did they want to? They never wanted to sign a DP as long as I was on the team.
That's right.
And this year they announced they signed a DP, but they weren't paying him. There was a lot of, Caraglio's, whatever, his situation, the loan and all that is what made him a DP. But sure. I am not a believer, and this is why I've said this all along, prove me otherwise. Who's won an MLS Cup with a DP? Yep. Let alone three.
That's right.
So... everyone wants to say, well, the Crafts aren't spending money on players. Well,
that's not true.
That could be said. That is true on the likes of Jeff Loreno with Andy Garman, Michael Parkhurst, James Riley, whatever, Pat Noonan, that line. But to say to go out and bring in DPs, you don't need to do it.
No.
Until someone proves now, that's part of the excitement that the way this league's going. But if you're based on wins and losses, and the way the salary cap is set up, you can be very successful. And Steve Nichol showed it. Now, did they have DPs on the roster, so to speak? Yeah, you could argue that Shaw Ree was a DP. Whatever that is. But I'm not saying, I don't know. The only guy that can truth, you and I are speculating, I don't really know how handcuffed Steve Nichol really was. But I'm not going to use that, I won't, as a crutch because we had enough good players on the team that we didn't need to go get DP.
Right.
And some of those guys should still be on the team.
Yeah. And so that brings up another question about who's making those kinds of decisions and, whether or not they're going to go the extra mile for guys like Jeff Loreno, it's Mike Parkhurst. And, is there kind of a perceived value? And that gets back to my other point about – you're living in 2002, 2003, when you thought you could just bring guys in, from a supplemental draft, get a guy out of Brown University, and he's going to be as good as Jeff Lorenowitz. Well, I think Jeff Lorenowitz, I think everybody that knows Jeff and he's won a MLS Cup, and I tip my cap to him. He's always been one of my favorite players, and he's obviously a very special player. And, I can't wait to see him in the men's national team mixture. If we can ever find a spot in the ever growing field of midfielders for the men's national team, but I just think in terms of let's turn it around now. So we've kind of identified some of the problems within the organization, but looking at potential coaching candidates, what kind of coach do you think the Revolution needs to help turn the ship around? I mean,
well, it depends on what they want to do, and to go back to what you said, I don't know if we've necessarily identified problems. We've identified questions.
Yes, that's true.
Because the answers might not be a problem, to be quite honest. So we don't know the answers, but we as fans and as ex-players, however you want to classify us, this podcast, whatever it is, but you guys, mainly, you guys have questions and you want answers. And this offseason, hopefully everyone gets those answers. So that's
or at least some
clarify.
Of them.
We haven't necessarily said the problem because we don't know the answer yet, right?
Right.
Now, the question is candidates. And I think it's way too early. I go online immediately and Twitter and people want to nominate myself. They want to nominate random people, anyone. It's way too early. I don't think they've even sat down, if you want my honest opinion, and really sat down. They're trying to catch their breath. I think they're trying to figure out some of the questions that we've asked and figure out roles. But these questions that you and I just brought up, Hank, I'm telling you right now, when you bring in the coach, you're going to ask those. So they got to be prepared for those answers. And what's concerning is I don't know what direction you want to go. So if you're going to bring in someone, are you going to tell them who assistant coaches are? Are you going to tell them who's going to help them pick players?
I don't think there's any coach in the league right now that would be willing to operate under that kind of strict management.
Right. That's as fans, that would be concerning, and I agree. Now, do we know? I mean, you and I are just speculating, which is so much fun. And I love the podcast, by the way, because it's an open forum and it's fun. It's the way sports should be. But we're speculating. We don't know how tight the management is. We don't know how loose it is. And that's what those meetings are. But I think when you start hearing candidates being interviewed and candidates being named, I don't know. I mean, you would have to think it's going to be tough to hire a coach with, let's say, a one-year contract with a one-year option.
Right.
And I mean, look at what Steve Nichol did. He was never under a contract early on. He just kept winning and earning that contract.
Yep.
You know, so I don't know, you know, if you're going to get someone, you know, look at what all these new teams do. I don't think Jesse Marsh went to Montreal saying, well, this is what you got to do. I don't think Peter Novak didn't do that in Philadelphia. He knows that he didn't go to Seattle. I mean, coaches, this is a legit league, and coaches are being paid legit dollars and having full staffs and stuff like that. So that's also the exciting thing, Hank, is I know it's unfortunate that Steve Nichol lost his job. But what if this next move opened the Pandora's box and this team and this organization takes the steps necessary to move forward?
That's kind of what everybody's hoping, is that I've gotten some feedback from people on Twitter, and basically this is the first step, right? It's the beginning of a possibility that the organization is taking this seriously and that they're willing to make some changes. And, you know, for me, the biggest sign of kind of complacency would have been to extend Steve Nichol with no questions asked, you know, going into the offseason. And I, as much as I appreciate everything Steve's done, I mean, no, there hasn't been a more, I don't know if this is an accurate statement, but for me, he's been the winningest coach that I remember in MLS. There's probably maybe Ziggy is better, but for me, it's always been Steve Nichol. The guy has always been the top, but I could just tell that this team wasn't moving forward, and I was one of those guys asking for change. But you know, and aside from all that, you've now got the ability to really kind of start over and start fresh. A concern for me, and I was going to touch briefly on this, is, you know, we've got this kind of management structure with Sunil Gulati in there, who's, you know, preoccupied, I think, in large part with USSF and other things going on in his career, maybe becoming part of CONCACAF, which is huge for the United States soccer. I think that's great. But I'm wondering how much impact this is going to have on the Revs organization. And you remember the kind of dancing around the maple he did with Klinsmann, you know, back before the last World Cup when we were trying to get him to come in, and there was questions about how much control he would have and how much control U.S. soccer wanted to have. I look at that as I'm wondering if there's a parallel here in the Revolution organization, and as the Revolution organization going to follow the new USSF model and allow the coach to have that extra freedom that I think he needs in order to succeed.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, very intelligent, and that's why Northeast, I love the Northeast sports fans, because I grew up in St. Louis, and St. Louis fans would go, oh, I thought I'd go Cardinals. Doesn't matter. They don't ask questions. which, by the way, there's some good things to that, too.
Yeah, there is. And I love the Cardinals organization. I have a good friend who's associated with them, and I wish them all the luck.
No, and there's something about the Midwest way, but I will tell you that, you know, you're asking smart questions, and these are things I would like to know. I think these are these questions are the ones that everyone, that these meetings have to be about. And if they want to attack the reasons of what are, and it comes down, in my opinion, and I could be totally off the reservation here with saying that they never had these, but I don't know if there's true delegation of what, whose job. What is the pecking order? What is the management? And if you bring in a guy for an interview, then I think that guy has the right to know. This is what Brunzi does. This is what Belello does. This is what Sunil Gulati does. By the way, Jonathan's the owner. No, but you know what I mean? Like, you don't need to delegate his role for that. These are all things that they have to be asked, because what I've noticed being away from the rest is everyone has a technical director. Everyone has presidents. Everyone has coaches, assistant coaches, equipment managers, strength and conditioning coaches. I mean, the sport has grown. My first year in 02, where we had to play Eastern Conference teams 13 times because of really, you know, we lost Tampa and Miami, and I'll be in. This is a legit league.
Right.
And legit organizations are run professionally, and there's a lot of positions to be had. And that's the main question. So to answer that, what Sunil's power is, I don't think anyone truly knows, do they?
Nobody knows. Nobody knows. He's the man behind the curtain.
Nobody knows what his role is, because let's be honest, whose quote was in the papers today?
I didn't.
Jonathan Kraft.
Yeah, and he's always been kind of that face, and he's trying to I think he's the one saying that there's, you know, we have some ultimate responsibility here. I'm the owner, you know, the Kraft Soccer organization's family organization. We're still here. We're still running the ship. And I think that that's important. But at the same time, I question how much involvement he actually takes.
No, it's because nobody knows, right?
He's
the owner. I have no problem with him having the quote. My question is that why does the president not have a quote?
Exactly. Where is he?
That's all I'm asking. And who knows? We could be totally off. Maybe there's a personal situation and the quote's going to come out tomorrow morning.
Right.
We don't really know that. But as of today, I haven't seen a quote from Sunil Gulati regarding Steve Nichol.
Yeah. So, Taylor, have you we did get one question from the chat room here. Have you had a chance to see what Jen Chang from SportsIllustrated.com, he had some tweets that went out there today about the New England front office unwilling to spend money and how the Revs had a chance to sign various named players such as Robbie Fowler, Paletta, and the organization basically wouldn't allow that kind of money to be spent. He says on one trip to South America that Nichol and his staff came back with a list of 20 players that they thought that would be able to take the Revs to the next level, and all would have been pricey by MLS standards, but affordable. But the Revs turned down the entire list. I mean, so this is kind of the black box, if you will, that I think people are starting to look into that we're kind of talking about here. I mean, do you have any insight? And I know we've kind of talked about it already, I think, and you've already probably answered this question, is the fact that nobody really knows what that organizational structure is. And
No. And we've already done that. But let's go back to those players. Are any of those players – let's go twofold. On the field, are those players going to make the Revs at that time, which was, if I recall, 07, 08, 09, 2010? Or would the team have been that much better?
Who knows? I mean, it's...
Let's be honest. Where was Robbie Fuller going to play in 2007?
Australia.
I mean, are you really going to take out Pat Noonan or myself?
Not in 2007. No, I wouldn't have.
let's go to 2008. Who are you going to take out there? Okay, so you let Noonan go to Norway. There's a small mistake there. Parkhurst isn't re-signed. Lorenowitz. So now you're going to bring in Robbie Fuller or Paletta for $3 million, let's say. Are you going to see that now off the field, those names? I don't see, and we may disagree. I'm not seeing Paul Weta and Robbie Fowler selling out tickets in Foxborough, Massachusetts.
I think that's an interesting side that a lot of people don't realize, and it's kind of people.
And I'm saying, hey, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'm saying, putting this in myself, because I'm going to write a check to a player. I mean, they told me what my worth was. They never believed I was worth a DP, so I said, okay, fair enough. But you're telling me that a Robbie Fowler, which would have been six times more than what I was being paid, would have sold more tickets to the point of making up that $3 million you're paying him. I don't think so. And this is when I hear fans go, we need DPs and spend money. Listen, David Beckham, he's paid it tenfold. Landon Donovan paid it. Has Rafa Marquez?
Not at all.
Not really.
Nope. I agree. It's a great point. A lot of people don't take that into account.
Yeah, I just don't. And we're trying to grow this league, which is the whole basis of this league starting in 96, was to make give the American player a chance to play to make the U.S. national team better. And what I'm a little concerned about right now is all of a sudden we're like, oh, yeah, we need to bring over DPs and foreigners. Whoa. This 2007 New England Revolution team had about 14 guys that could start on any team in the league right now. And they could have had a lot of them on that team today, this year. Now, granted, if Lorena was in dormant on the team, you probably can't bring in Benny Failhaber. But you might be able to, because then 12 retired. You know what I mean? There's a lot of finagling, and we're in hindsight. But if Jen Chang and these people want to say, well, they've never spent the money, I'm the first one to defend the crafts. Unless I know I'm going to sell 30,000 seats every game, why am I going to pay $3 million for a guy that's overaged?
So, where do you draw the line, though? Because, you know, you look at a lot of guys that are, you know, maybe not Fowler now, but Fowler five years ago.
I'll draw the line. Here's one, Freddie Montero. He's obviously not old.
Not at all.
No, so it's the young guy you got to go get, and then when you sign him.
I love that idea.
And there's the difference. Severino for Salt Lake, when they won, he wasn't a DP. They had to then buy him, and that's why they signed into a new deal.
So there's really – and this is kind of addressing somebody in the chat room right now is talking about bringing in extra quality. So there's ways to improve the quality on the field, not necessarily by signing an over and what we would, let's just label him an over the hill player, but maybe this guy's a serviceable player for another 3 or 4 years. But really, the future, in your opinion, is with these younger players that, like a Freddie Montero, we'll say a Diego Fagundes. I mean, I think we could agree that that was a smart signing on the Revolution.
It is. I mean, are we jumping the ship on Diego Fagundes? 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, the kid's young.
Yes, he's very, very young. But at the same time, I don't think we can invest our entire future in Diego Fagundes.
No, but now let's go back. I'm going to go back to it, and I'm like Pete and repeat on a boat. Pete fell off, so I'm repeat. But here we go. Why is that? And why does everyone bring up the Freddie Montero's and young foreigners when the college draft? Look at who Steve Nichol and his staff drafted.
Right.
So now there's my question. Why are all of those guys, and I've said this, so no one from the Revolution is going to be mad about me saying this on the podcast, but why are those guys asked to play their contract out all 4 years at the minimum? That's the only thing that I wish would change. The moment Andy Dorman has his second good year, I would have signed him.
Right.
So then when the fourth year comes up and the player is extremely upset, and he's played 4 years at the minimum, which guys at the time wasn't 40 that it is now, it was 24, and Andy played at the developmental contract at 12 grand. See, there's something here that I'm never one that's going to say, yeah, we got to go to Colombia, South America, and find all these young guys. Well, you might hit the jackpot the way the Revolution did from 02. You get Shalrie Joseph in the second round, Pat Noonan, Michael Parker, James Riley, Clint Dempsey, Andy Dorman, Jeff Lorenowitz.
Right.
Why are none of those guys on your team?
It's an excellent question. And, you know, that I think we kind of talked about that back when we were talking about, you know, who's responsible for setting the, you know, for signing the players and signing the deals and these other kind of nebulous things that happen within this organization. But, you know, also we have to look now at and it's kind of a good segue into, you know, the team is at a crossroads. You know, is it do we keep Shaury Joseph on this team next year? Do we does the team need him that much? It's going to be a big number on the salary cap. And I know you're friends, so if you don't want to if you want to take this somewhere else, that's fine. But, you know, we've got to ask the questions, you know, what does this team need? Who are the players that are going to make this team succeed? You know,
isn't that what you get? That's what those people. That's what whoever's job title it is and whoever's decision that is, that's why you get paid the bucks. You got to make those tough decisions.
Right.
And listen, Shaury, unbelievable run. But does a new coach want to come in and have him, how old is he now?
33, something like that. Yep.
Right. So does a new coach, I mean, that's something in the interview. You get interviewed. Do you say, well, is Shaury on my team? Is Matt Reese on my team? Can I rebuild? Well, you know what I mean? These are all questions that they'll be answered eventually by the moves made by the organization and so forth.
This is a huge – if I remember – and I don't know if this is going to happen this year. I haven't checked it. I don't think there's been an announcement from the league as to when the MLS reentry draft is going to be. But Shaury's at the end of his contract. Do you think that he's – I mean, last year was in December when the reentry draft was. I mean, these questions have got to be answered quickly. And if they're going into this reentry draft and they want to pick up guys like Shaury, maybe the team goes ahead and tenders an offer to Shaury. And if the new guy comes in and says after the fact and says, you know what, I think I can get two or three players for if I trade Shaury to New York or, you know, trade him to DC or Philadelphia or something along those lines. And I could easily see Shaury signing for New York and spending his last couple of years down in the city. But not saying that I want that to happen, Shaury. Don't get me wrong.
Listen, what everyone needs to realize, this is sports. And
it's a business.
Very few guys get to play for the same organization their entire career.
Right.
And there's very tough decisions that need to be made. There's really part of me, and the tough thing is, listen, I played for the rest. And that was the only team I played for. And there's something about this situation that obviously I'm not going to sit here and lie to you. I'm very intrigued by. And when I see Cam Neely win a Stanley Cup after playing for the Bruins, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think and dream about maybe doing that for the rest. But you have to make a decision because is this, you know, do you believe that the roster right now should be in the playoffs?
Absolutely
that's
not.
The question, and definitely not. So if that's the case, then that new guy coming in, or new guys, whoever it is, whatever it is, you, at some point, you know, no one wants to say it because it's like, oh my, it's a dreadful word. But I'm okay saying it. It's okay to rebuild. It's not a bad thing to rebuild by any means, because that means there's a light at the end of the tunnel. But you got to ask yourself, do you believe this roster with a new coach is in the playoffs next year? And the answer is no. I mean, I think I would answer for you and a lot of people. I don't think the answer is no.
Well, you know, and I have a hard time saying no flat out because so many of the Revolution's games were lost in the last two or three minutes of the game, you know, or they lost, they ended up drawing or – and it's all kind of defensive lapses or, you know, not being able to sustain the pressure or...
Right, so is that...
Is that coaching or is that execution? I mean, I can't answer that question. I coach 14-year-olds. I mean,
right.
I get, you know, 45, 50% effort every day. So I'm not used to that. You know, collapses for me can happen in the first 10 minutes, but...
Right. I'm not going to, you know, listen, it's reality. It's our job. We're not 14, and this isn't our college team. Fact of the matter is, if you're having a lot of mental lapses and losing a lot of games, but Steve Nichols not on the field.
Right.
and call me crazy, but the moment I crossed the white line and I was on the field, and I know a lot of guys that I played with, it didn't really matter what the head coach, he told you what the game plan was, but you got to make the decisions. Ultimately, you can't look at the coach every time and ask him what decision you're making.
It's true.
And see, that's just part of me. That, you know, you hear the coaching, and it, you know, people say this about Bob Bradley. You know, how come mental lapses all the time? Bob prepared teams better than one of. I mean, I've never seen a coach prepare as much as Bob Bradley. Was it over preparation? Whatever, doesn't matter. It still was us. Once the whistle blew, Bob Bradley, Steve Nichol, coaches aren't holding your hands playing the game.
Well, you know, and that brings up an interesting point. I feel like I've got a teleprompter here for the chat room here, but it's one of the guys here is saying, you know, there was some players quoted as after the 3-0 loss to Philadelphia, the players coming out of the locker room saying we didn't have a game plan. We didn't know what the game plan was coming into this game. I mean, where does that fall into this? I mean, is that them not paying attention to Steve Nichol, or does Steve Nichol not communicating, or is this an aberration?
I don't know. I'm not actually going to answer that because I don't know how to answer that. Cause I would have been one, if I lost 3-0, guess what? I'm taking blame. One, I didn't score a goal. So we lost 3-0. So that was partially my fault.
Right.
I say that half-heartedly as a joke, but the reality is, look yourself in the mirror and take responsibility for yourself.
That's good.
And that's just how I was. And I'm not preaching to the choir here, but if I missed a breakaway, or I missed a penalty kick, or I did this, you raise your hand, you're man enough, you own up to it, and you move on. But the reason why we're still talking about that is because now there's a deflection. There is the quote of, there wasn't a game plan. There still was, when the whistle blew, 11 guys against 11 guys. And I understand preparation as a player, and I understand all that. There's no game plan. But that didn't mean, and I remember the Philadelphia game, that didn't mean you couldn't track your defender, Carlos Ruiz, inside the 6-yard box. There's no game plan to that. Stop him from scoring, right?
Right.
And so that's my only thing. So I'm not going to really answer it because, listen, you screw up, you raise your hand, you say it was my bad, move on. But to deflect it, I don't know.
Yeah. That's always hard to do because, you know, we have to say, everybody's a little bit at fault, right? I mean, you've got the players on the field have to win and they have to perform and they have to know their jobs. And if, you know, that 3-0 loss to Philadelphia, I mean, it was halfway through the season, if not in the second half of the season, if I'm not mistaken. So,
right.
I mean, that's, if you don't know your job by that point, then something's going wrong. And it's.
Yeah. And that goes, and that's why Steve Nichol deserves, as because of his position as being a head coach, that's why he deserves whatever blame he gets.
Exactly.
I just want people to realize, and this is why I have said it all day to certain people, he doesn't get all the blame.
Nope.
And that's what people got to make sure. And that's why this decision's made. You move on. And now the questions need to be answered. And that is management or whatnot. But, yeah, of course, coach, as your job is to prepare the guys until the whistle blows. But guess what? When the whistle blows, did any of my players listen? Did any of my players absorb what we're trying to do? And does that anyone have it in their heart of hearts that I want to do whatever I can to win this game?
Right. And it comes back to everybody's got to take accountability. And we talked about that earlier in the podcast. So,
and what's funny, Hank, too, is when you see the players close, I want to make sure I say this, too. You can tell players are bummed.
Yeah.
Because they know. That locker room knows. You know, they're not idiots. They're professionals. They understand that, you know what, this stinks because Steve Nichol lost his job because I didn't do this, this, and this, and there's some recollection going on. You can see that. And I don't want this to think that I'm jumping all over the players, but I'm just defending the fact that if you're going to say it's a game plan and whatnot of Steve Nichol, well, that game against Philadelphia was at the end of June.
All right, we got another question from the chat room here. It's saying, if you were Sunil Gulati or if we assuming that we understand what Sunil Gulati's role is, but if you're Sunil Gulati, you're president of the Kraft Soccer, tomorrow, what are the first three things you're doing to help this organization out?
I don't know. I will tell you, the first thing I would do is live in Boston so I can be more around the team.
Good answer.
But again, I'm not Sunil Gulati, and I'll never be Sunil Gulati because I'll never be the president of U.S. Soccer and understand what it's like to be the president of two things at once. And really, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a tough one to grasp. Because not only does he control the New England Revolution according to his title, but holy cow, he's got to run U.S. Soccer? I mean, I'd have 17 iPhones.
and he's also a professor, let's not forget.
Yeah, exactly. And he's a professor. I can't believe I forgot that. So, very bright individual. I would move to Boston. I'd be around this a lot more. I'd be more hands-on, but that's just me.
Yeah, I think
I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'd have a sit-down meeting and really delegate what everyone's role is, and I'm sure
that's
he's
great.
Done that already. It's not anything like that. And then, listen, I'm going to just say it how it is. I'm making a move that gets this fan base re-energized because I can't guarantee you that the soccer-specific stadium, if I'm Sunil Gulati, is coming in the next 12 months or however long. But I'll tell you one thing. I want those fans. I want everyone behind the Revolution like we had those 5, 6, 7 years, because it was fun to go down to Gillette. Teams hated playing against us in Boston, hated it. And then my next move, whoever I hire or however many people I hire, whatever I do, is to keep in mind to get these fans, season ticket holders back on board and let either, if I use the word rebuilding or not, it doesn't matter. I want the fans to say to my face that, we're going. But I'm a little different. You guys know, you saw me play. I wore my emotions on my sleeve. I don't know ever how to new field.
Yeah. Well, he's not really around for us to kind of get a read on that. And when he is, we don't get a chance to talk to him. So it's, I think it's important that, you're not Sunil Gulati, and nobody here is Sunil Gulati, and nobody would really be in a position where they could hold down three jobs at once. I don't know any human in the world that really can.
No.
So it's.
And by the way, we're not talking three easy, easy jobs, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, they're not. And, I have a hard time just going to my day job and running a podcast on the side. It's a lot of fun for me to do this, and obviously I'm very privileged to get the chance to meet players and talk with guys like you and all that great stuff that comes along with it. But at the same time, if I was to do this and my day job on a daily basis, I'd go crazy. I mean, I'd go nuts, and my kids wouldn't see me, and that would drive me nuts. So you talk about re-energizing the team there's probably no magic kind of formula there, but do you think that this team could get re-energized if they were to bring in somebody like a couple of your former teammates have been named as potential replacements? And that, like you said, I don't think they've had a chance to even sit down and figure out what they want out of a head coach. But if somebody like Steve Ralston was to come in here after to come back, or Jay Heaps, leave the commentator's booth, leave his job at Morgan Stanley, come back and become the head coach for the Revolution. Do you think that would be the kind of re-energizing factor that this team could galvanize around? Do you think it would be effective?
Shouldn't I be asking you that?
Well, for me, I don't know. I mean, I've had the chance to talk with Jay at some of the training sessions and the practices. I think he's a very knowledgeable guy, and we've all saw him perform, just as we saw you perform out on the field for us, and he wore his heart on his sleeve probably more than anybody. I still remember the red card he got at the end of the game, at the end of the Superliga game, where he was just letting everybody that was in his way have it. And I just think that typified kind of my impression of Jay Heaps as a player. But you sit down and talk to him, he's a very calm and composed kind of individual. I can't imagine what he would be like as a coach. And so I'm kind of asking you, do you think that Jay Heaps would be a good coach?
you bring up Steve Ralston, Jay Heaps,
yeah.
And as their ex-teammate and friend, not going to find two guys that want to win more than anyone and that are going to be very diligent and two very different people. What everyone needs to remember, though, is Steve Ralston right now is in the midst of MLS Cup playoffs.
That's right.
And he's in the midst of, you know, a Houston team that's hot, real hot right now, because they've finally, someone's realized that Jeff Cameron is going to be the future center back, that he can be if he learns certain things. But they've solidified their defense. They're now scoring goals. They're hot going into the playoffs. What if they win MLS Cup? You know, Steve Ralston sees the game very differently. Jay Heaps, listen, everyone goes, at Morgan Stanley, the TV commentator. Listen, the moment I knew Jay Heaps, 1999, I was a freshman, 98, sorry, freshman at the University of Maryland. Jay Heaps is the senior at Duke, and the guy was one of the most competitive, annoying guys to play against. And when he's on your team, you absolutely love him. Because yep. He knew he was on your team. And so people think that Jay left the game and went into Morgan Stanley. I haven't had this conversation with Jay Heaps, but I'll tell you right now, if someone told him that he could help rebuild the New England Revolution franchise in some capacity, I can guarantee he's going to show up tomorrow morning at 5:30 a.m.
That's excellent.
And I can guarantee you, if Steve Ralston's asked that, he'll do the exact same. Now, the question you asked me is not about those two, but it's more about, is that type of move going to re-energize the fan group? I don't know that. I'm not in that fan group.
Right.
You know what I mean? So that's something for your colleagues and friends, because I don't know that answer, but you would sure think it would, wouldn't it?
I would think it would be a big help. I think a lot of fans, a lot of the diehard fans would welcome it, that. The only caveat there is, A, you know, Jay doesn't have any professional coaching experience. Steve Ralston has a year and a half.
Did Jason Christ?
Jason Christ didn't either. That's the amazing thing. And you talk about a guy who had a game plan.
Right.
He and Garth Lagerwey got together and said, this is our game plan. And
yeah, but what people forget, though, is I don't think Jason Christ started out on fire at Salt Lake.
No. Well, his team, it wasn't an overnight success.
No.
That's for sure.
And that's the point, though. He was given the rope, however you want to say it, long enough to learn on the fly, but it was his personality, his desire to succeed. Now Jason Christ is one of the best coaches in MLS.
That's true.
So I mean, you're not going to hear me, no coaching experience, this or that. Ben Olsen did a great job with DC this year.
Yep.
Well, he had until the final weekend to make the playoffs.
And it's smart, and he had the ability there to go out and get the player he wanted to help make that happen. And that's that kind of freedom, or kind of, you know, say, hey, ownership.
Who was the player he wanted?
Dwayne DeRosario.
Yes. Okay. Well, I didn't know, because Charlie Davies was on the team, and everybody makes it sound like Ben Olsen went out and got him. That was more.
That was more like Charlie Davies fell to him. Yeah. It was,
right.
And so
I just wanted to clarify that. Yeah, DeRosario went out and got it, but that was a deal that New York. I mean, whatever.
Yeah, Toronto wouldn't trade. Toronto wouldn't trade with Ben back in the time, but you know. It was when they traded him to New York. New York was in a position to, you know, to benefit from a trade. They took advantage of it, and yeah, I think it probably worked out in DC's favor there. You look at the.
Well, of course they, but I'll tell you right now, if New England was offered DeRosario and they had Dax McCarty, they would have done the deal too.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So I don't know if it was so much Ben Olsen, but it is whatever.
Yeah.
Apples and oranges. We don't. Yeah. Even, this is a Rev show. I'd rather talk about Revs anyway.
Right. Absolutely. Well, yeah, and let's. We've been going for a while now, and I promise I would keep you for a half hour.
Gotta
you got to go.
I've been on for an hour. You're going to get me in trouble.
Well, let's do. Let's just ask you one. I can't let you go without first talking about the Midnight Riders FIFA 12 tournament that's going to be held November 8th at the Greatest Bar in Boston. I believe that's where we're where they're holding
that's right,
it.
Yeah,
And that's
you guys. The Midnight Riders have just whatever. It's been awesome. Absolutely. I feel part of the group, always have, always will. I've got the Man of the Year awards. I've got some of my dog biscuits in. Some got it just there around the house. And the Midnight Riders have felt forever part of what I'm doing. And I'm in the process of starting a foundation thinktailor.org. And right. You guys want to start it off. You guys want to start it off the right way, and why not? Let's play some FIFA November 8th and have some fun.
Right, and you can find details on that at midnightriders.com. But so Taylor, I want to thank you for that. But are you one last question? Are you playing in the tournament?
I'll play for sure. Depends on how big the TV is, because I don't want to get any of my concussion symptoms. But I'm sure I'm not going to be able to stay away from my controller.
Right. So do you have any insight as to who else is coming, and any prediction as to who's going to win the whole thing?
No, obviously with the news the last couple of days, we don't. The Revs don't really know what they're doing this offseason. So they may be traveling, they may be training. So hopefully we'll get wind of that soon, and we'll get some guys to come. Either way, it's going to be a good time, and it'll be fun.
All right. Well, if you're playing, my money's on you. I'll definitely be. I'll definitely be there. I don't have the Xbox, so I'm not wise in those ways, so I'll just have to be a spectator, but I'm sure it's going to be a blast. So Taylor, thanks so much for coming on. I'm sorry I kept you so long, but it was worth it, and I hope some other can get you come back on some other time.
No, it was absolutely awesome, and just let's keep the faith, you know.
Absolutely.
Steve Nichol had a great run for 10 years, awesome run, and you know, it's time for a new beginning, and it's all exciting. This is all good news.
Absolutely. And thanks again, pal. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in the chat room. And we appreciate all the feedback that we've gotten from the fans today, and it's been great. Stay tuned for next time we're on the Midnight Ride. We'll see what else we got for you. But nothing really can top Taylor Twellman. I might just have to retire myself. So.
See but, you guys.
All right. Thanks a lot, pal. And you've been listening to the Midnight Ride. We'll talk to you guys next week. Cheers.